Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bodhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So we are chanting the verse about the dependent origination every day, twice. And it's very, I must say, it's very helpful. I really enjoy that. So I start reflecting on certain terms, on these different stages. And I think from yesterday when Ajahn Amaro was from his talk in the evening, I just stayed more with Salayatana. So we have Nama Rupa, Salayatana, Paso, and then Vedana. So Salayatana is usually translated as the sixfold sense base. So what is that? Yeah, hidden behind that is something very simple. I mean, it's actually not simple, but it's something we are all very familiar with. So you have the six senses. In Buddhism, that is the eye, the nose, the tongue, the ears, the body, and the mind. So in order for to have a sense experience, we need three things, which is the sense organ, so these bases. Then we need the respective object. So for the eye, it would be a visible form. For the ear, it would be an audible sound, and so on. And then we often forget really the mind. So what is the mind object? The mind object can be a thought. It can be a mental image, which is interesting because it can be based on sense experience from the eye, but the association, you know, the remembering of an eye object is actually a mental experience. So we have the sense base, the sense object, and then the third element is the sense consciousness. So we have six sense consciousnesses, eye consciousness, and so on. So being born into a human body, it means that we have to deal with these six sense consciousnesses and all what the eye gets into contact to. So if we close our eyes, it seems as if there is no sense object, which is only partly true because you can still see with closed eyes. What you see is relative darkness. And when you move your hand, so if I move my hand now here, I can actually see a difference in as a shadow, as if a shadow is moving through. So we still see with closed eyes, but it's a very neutral vision, a very boring vision in a way. So for that reason, we never pay really attention to what we see with closed eyes. I mean, with the physical eye, really. And so, of course, when you're unconscious, you can't see either. When you sleep, you are still in these states where you can have mental images. And also, you might remember that when you wake up, sometimes you wake up from something you have heard and you have built it into your dream. So it's you know, once the sense object is penetrating the consciousness, penetrating to the consciousness, then we can even wake up from that. And even people in coma who are said to be unconscious, they actually, to a certain degree, understand what's going on around them. So people have made experience with coma patients. One incident I remember is I think Stephen Levine is writing about that, a coma patient, and he has this, Stephen Levine is visiting him, he's lying in hospital, and so he's visiting him, and he knows somehow that coma patients are not dead, they're not brain dead, so somehow they perceive something, although they don't respond. So he, knowing that he, or believing in that, he started reading things to this person or speaking with that person. And at some point he stopped reading and looked out of the window and saw a kingfisher flying by. And he was, oh, a kingfisher. And in that moment, the person who was in a coma got up, opened their eyes, looked out of the window, and fell back into the coma. So, I mean, that was just a very funny incident, you know, but it's just good to remember that there are different, how can I say that, intensities of consciousness. So there might be very latent consciousness, which, you know, maybe machines or whatever, doctors don't recognize, but obviously it's there. Anyway, so little detour, sense consciousness. So we need the three coming together, the three elements, the sense itself, the physical sense, the object, and the sense consciousness. And then there's contact, so passo. So that's where we register what is happening. And then the next step is vedana, feeling. You know, vedana is pleasant, unpleasant, or painful, or neutral. Can be either of them. Can be very pleasant, can be a little bit pleasant. So, but the Buddha gives ways we feel, because that is very important then for what happens next. So when we have something which is strongly pleasant, you know what happens. We want it, or we want it to last. So then the longing, the, you know, craving, movement, the next movement is happening. That's very interesting. Then, you know, once the avicca comes in, the sense of self, then there's this me and this object, and then there's something I need to get or need to stay with me. Or if it's unpleasant, then there's a me which needs to get away from something. or maybe defend myself against something. So with this split into me and other, then the craving or the aversion, the negative way of craving, is the result. So things become a bit complicated here. And then, of course, you know, you have clinging and you have, and so on. You know, you go into birth, you become it. The owner of the car, and then the one who has to deal with all the complications. So Ajahn Amaro has very vividly described it yesterday. So Salayatana is so nice, you know. You have the sense, you have the sense object, you have the sense experience. Why can't we stay with that? There's the sutta, the Bahia Sutta, where I think Ajahn Amaro was mentioning that shortly. So Bahia is a ascetic, a quite achieved ascetic, who thinks sometimes he's even enlightened, but somehow he has a kind of connection with an Arahant friend, and somehow in meditation he sometimes connects with him, and the Arahant friend told him, "You are not enlightened, you have to see the Buddha." So Bhaya starts wandering and finds out where the Buddha is and reaches the place where the Buddha is, and it's just alms round time. So the Buddha is on alms round, and Bhaya goes towards the Buddha and asks him to get a teaching. He says, "Life is short, you know, please teach me." And the Buddha says, "No, Bhaya, it's alms round time, you know, come later." And so he asks three times, and when the Buddha is asked three times, he has to answer. So he gives him a very short teaching, and basically, you know, shortly, it is, Bahia, this is how you should train yourself. In the seen, there's merely the seen. In the heard, there's merely the heard. In the sensed, there's merely the sensed. And in the cognized, there's merely the cognized. Thus you should train yourself. And if you train yourself, Bahia, in this, then in the seen and in the, you know, heard, whatever, you will not be in there. You will not be. Oh, it's very kind of difficult English for me. You will not be within. You will not be through that. You will not be. You will be either, neither here nor there, nor in between. Thus, that is the end of suffering. And so, okay, so in the scene, there's merely the scene. So then there's no me seeing something and having to react. So it just stays with the pure seeing or hearing or sensing, which can be, you know, smelling, tasting, or touching, and mere cognizing. So that's liberation. It could be so easy. And you may remember situations, you know, like these kind of archetypal situations, like a sunset, you know, you just get very quiet. And we can be just this gazing, just this awe of what we see. There are no words. We hate people if they start saying, "Oh, isn't this a nice sunset?" Shut up. So, you know, this sense of just opening the heart and being with what is. And, you know, and you can mess it up by making photos, because then that in that moment you try to fix it, you know, you try to conserve it and show it your friends later. So and nothing is more boring than seeing slides of sunsets and hearing somebody, oh, and then we were there and look, this beautiful sunset. Another one of those. So, and sometimes we can even see photos of beautiful sunsets. And it's not the photo which really does the trick, but it's more our memory. You know, also our memory can connect us with that opening of the heart experience. And you can see children, you know, they can, when you're small children and they, I don't know who of you remembers when you have seen your first Christmas tree. It's wordless. So there are certain things which are so beautiful that they are breathtaking. They are you know, beyond words. So we have this sensing. But then we start talking about it, then we want to have it again. So every Christmas. And then you don't have that awe-inspiring experience. You may have the memory, you know. So Ajahn Sumedho is speaking about intuitive awareness. So intuitive awareness, which is just aware of the way things are without thinking about it, without making anything out of it. Ajahn Chah was saying, you know, listen, don't listen with your ears, listen with your heart. So there's an, you know, all embracing seeing where you are not the seer, where seeing is just happening. In the seeing, there's merely the seeing, the seen. Ajahn Sumedho also calls it apperception. It's perception before the, you know, when scientists speak about that, when we perceive something, they say we are not even able to perceive what I see. I'm not able to perceive what I see because before the actual sense data reach that part of the brain which perceives them, the quicker route is to the center in the brain which has the memories and checks the experience. Is it safe? Is it? So, or you know, if you see whatever, a dog, you know, you don't go, okay, how does, you know, then it's a very quick checking, which happens unconsciously, whether this dog is somebody you better run away from, or you say, oh, nice, you know. So, and that's probably a survival instinct, so an inbuilt mechanism in our way that the neural pathways function, you know, that the checking has to be so quick that you can take action immediately. So it's not this kind of, oh, you know, embrace the experience. The embrace the experience may happen when we know things are safe, you know. So, yeah, scientists say you can't even perceive things without the checking. And I think probably they haven't studied meditators enough. It might be possible that they, I think, change their view if they would know more about meditation, you know, where direct experience, we actually train ourselves in direct experience. So if you have done your bit of samatha meditation, calming the mind, and then you open up to what is and just allow it to come and to go, arise and pass, that's actually where this intuitive awareness is working. And often we don't stay just open and let it come and go. We kind of hook in and it triggers memories, associations, and then we start thinking and creating situations in our minds. And that's the kind of daydreaming we can fall into in meditation. So, and that's actually very good if that happens, because you can study that. You can become conscious of it, aware of it, and you can study that, because that is what happens so much in everyday life, where we wind ourselves up with these inner comments, you know, oh God, this person again, you know, God, I knew that. we have memories, and then we make assumptions, and we create actually what we don't want. And that is where addiction comes in. So Ajahn Amo was combining, you know, the theme addiction with Paticca Samuppada, because Paticca Samuppada is such a good system where you can really see how addiction is created. And maybe I speak a little bit about the chemistry of addiction, because that may explain why addiction is so hard to overcome, even addiction to emotions and thoughts. So I don't want to make it too complicated. So science clearly says that every thought has its own chemical which is released in the body as soon as you start thinking this thought. So every thought has its own chemical footprint or concoction, or, you know, it's, and these chemicals are peptides, are neurotransmitters, and are hormones. So they are created in our glands, in our different parts of the body, actually. Anyway, I don't want to make it too complicated. So when you have, for example, something happens and you think, oh, this person shouldn't say that, you just by saying it like this, you can see how it turns towards anger. So this thought of this person should know better, this person shouldn't say that, this thought immediately creates some kind of chemical reaction, like adrenaline. You know, you release a bit of adrenaline. So now adrenaline is a very interesting substance, because it goes to the receptors which sit on top of the cells. And have a strong effect on, so the receptors react in creating, anyway, not too complicated. So the DNA gets informed, so the nucleus and the cell gets informed and reacts to that. So with adrenaline is such an aggressive substance that it does, the receptors get high on it, so they want more of it. And then if they get too much, they actually get damaged, and then they don't function any longer. And then slowly the cell degenerates. So when we have lots of adrenaline coming in, it actually creates weakness and degeneration in the body. And yet, if we have these feelings of anger again and again, what happens is that the body has a homeostasis system where things which happen quite often, we get used to them, and that they get integrated into what is the inner balance, the physical balance. And so when somebody is used to have adrenaline very often, if they have a too peaceful time, that means they have a bad time. So the body starts like a drug addict, you know, starts saying, where's my stuff? And then, you know, sends signals to the brain, here, come on, you know, where are the angry thoughts? And even it's really where the limbic system, the emotional brain is kind of running the show suddenly, so that even although you might be a good meditator and Buddhist, and now I don't want to create angry thoughts any longer, but if you are used to have angry thoughts, your glands will tell you to produce these adrenaline basically. And if you don't, they even produce the adrenaline on their own, and that creates the angry thoughts. So you can sit in a completely peaceful environment and you get these angry thoughts suddenly, and you don't know where they come from, because there's actually nothing which makes you angry in this situation. So, if that happens in meditation, it's fairly safe. But imagine you speak with somebody and, you know, that person tries to kind of calm you down and you have this kind of... So you will find a reason why this person is wrong, and you will tell them, because that makes you, you know, utterly the body happy, basically. In the mind, you might afterwards, oh, God, I did it again, and I don't want it, you know. So this is how... it happens again and again, and we just beat ourselves up because we don't really understand why this could happen again. So I say that because these mechanisms are active in meditation as well, and you might want to concentrate on the breath, you know. Yes, beginning and end, you know, and really. And then... Shut up! And basically what we do, we blame ourselves. If we are addicted to blame, we do it to ourselves. If we are addicted to, depression, oh God, I can't do it, so it's the same. And so it's just a program, it's a loop. You know, it's really a loop. And so how do we break through that? I mean, the Buddha said, you know, there are two ways suffering ripens. So one is we fight against it, and or we try to get away from it. And the other one is to acknowledge it and become interested in it, and trying to have faith that accepting it, following the teachings of the Buddha, actually help us going beyond suffering. So you have the normal way and you have the faith way. So if we start to do meditation in the normal way, and kind of I beat my anger down, I beat my whatever down, that's taking the wrong step, I believe, because we just reaffirm the old addiction again. So the you know, seeing the way it is, trying to see that this is impersonal, it's actually a physical reaction, helps to decharge, to see that when I fight against it or try to get away from it, that will increase the suffering, the second noble truth. So what I can do is I can, yes, that's the way it is. Can I accept that? Can I make peace with that? Can I stay with that? And that sounds like you do nothing, but you actually do a huge step forward. You know, you really make a difference. So, making peace with it. And also the Buddha is speaking about uplifting the heart. So faith can also uplift the heart. Faith in the teachings of the Buddha can, you know, when my reaction is, oh, I can't do anything, it's always the same with me. Oh, it doesn't lead anywhere, you know, I could disrobe as well. You know, I just sit here, I'm not worth the alms food, you know. then I make myself victim, you know, to these hormones and peptides and whatever. So knowing that, I can, you know, how do I increase faith? You know, the Buddha gives us certain teachings. We can find out what helps. We can try out. So there is always a way. We just have really to find out what helps. We can't go to a teacher and say, oh, tell me what I should do. The teacher can tell you, you know, oh, the Buddha has taught this, and try out for yourself. So that's really what convinced me of the Buddha's teaching, that he said, you know, I can only share my experience and teach, you know, what I have found out, but you have to find out for yourself. So it's not about believing it. It's about, okay, you know, I'm empowered here to find out for myself. So, and when it doesn't work, then I have to look for something different. And if you're an anger type, the Buddha recommends that you work with loving kindness. If you're kind of more sense-oriented, sensual pleasure type, you better don't work with loving kindness. You better work with contemplating the body as impermanent and not self. So there are certain strategies he offers, and we can try that. And I would like to share just a few things which I find helpful. So when I came, I didn't like the chanting at all. I wasn't used to devotional chanting and, you know, the Lord. Thank you. And I was lucky that you know, so I was brought up in German, in Germany. So in German, for me, it's the Lord is not that bad. You know, if I would have to chant it in German, I would have had a stronger reaction. So, okay, the Lord was just doable. But then there were other things which I just hated. You know, like, how can I ordain? I really wanted to ordain. How can I ordain when I hate the chanting? And what helped me was a retreat, just a weekend retreat with Ajahn Ariasilo, and he just did, you know, counting the breath. But it brought me into this kind of quiet mind state where my usual reactions were not there. And I remember, you know, the retreat ends Sunday afternoon, and then I went to evening puja. And so we did the evening puja in the sala at that time. And so the Lord, it was so beautiful. What? Why, you know, why is that beautiful suddenly? And I realized that my mind was so calm that my usual reactions were not there. So I said, oh God, now I can ordain. And I mean, you know, my reactions came back, but I didn't believe in them any longer, because I had experienced that they are just reactions, you know. So I was really grateful for that retreat. So devotional chanting, I mean, now I have good days and bad days, but usually the chanting really uplifts me. And especially when the days are bad, you know, we have that also as monastics, we have our difficult days. And The chanting really puts me back into place, because it's not so much just the chanting, it's also that I see if I just fill my mind with positive aspirations, you know, it makes a difference. So that is the empowerment. And then I can sit in meditation and it goes like, oh God, you know, this person again, you know, I'm living here in the monastery because I want to give something. And then somebody comes and, you know, okay, stop. You know, if I think like this, there's actually quite some pain inside. So do I want to continue creating this pain? Not good, you know, not good for my heart, not good for the chemistry. No, I don't want to do that. So, okay, what can I do? Okay, so that person may have, I'm thinking about, you know, I'm complaining about, may have some attitudes which I don't like, but maybe I look at that person from a different angle. They might also have attitudes which are actually very beautiful. Can I bring up a few of them? Well, you know, sometimes I can really feel my resistance then, you know, how I hold on to the resistance, because there's some kind of gratification in it. So, okay, then I make it my practice really to remember the good things this person is doing. And it's, you know, yes, yeah, well, yes, yeah, it's actually quite good. So it's a little work. And it's very interesting work, because I can experience the holding onto something, you know, and the sense of how my sense of self increases, actually, you know, when I don't like something. So that's very interesting. And so I made it sometimes my practice to write little notes to somebody whom I found difficult and say, I really appreciated that you came to the chanting today because I felt supported by your chanting. You know, but sometimes we are only few. And that person received the note, and that's strange, so then she writes a positive thing to me. Because you get, over the time, you get really into, you know, oh, I don't like that person, and that person, oh, she doesn't like me. So I really made it a practice to find something beautiful and to write notes. And suddenly I got these positive notes back from that person. So something really happened in the way we were meeting. And so we can do it, you know. And it does need a bit creativity and goodwill sometimes. So it's really good to be aware that ill will is not just, you know, I want to hit somebody. Ill will is also just to think negative thoughts about somebody. And this is not something I want to do to myself. So it's not that I want to be goody-goody. It's really that I don't want to do it to myself. So I have to make a step forward. And so just the chant, we have so beautiful chants, so sometimes to chant the words of on loving kindness or the divine abidings, the four divine abidings, or sharing the blessings, these are all so incredible, powerful chants. You know, the sharing the blessings, when you share the blessings of your life with, yeah, okay, your teachers, that's, you know, you understand that. But then you even chant it to those who are hostile, even to the Lord of Death. So that's powerful. You know, you don't get hooked into, oh God, you know, you actually have the strength to give them something. We have that sometimes, you know, here, you get sometimes very sensitive. And then, oh, that person, you know, bad energy, so better go. Or you sit in your room and suddenly something comes, sits on you, and God, you know, they say there are spirits around. You know, you can have a sleepless night. And I don't know whether they are or whether it's just imagination, but you don't know. So what I do is, if I have a strong feeling of there's something here, I actually make a deal with them. I say, please don't disturb me. I do my meditation practice here. And I'm willing to share my merits with you, you know. So you better don't disturb me, and you will get the good results. And it works. I mean, for me. yeah, and the modern night chanting, you know, the sharing of blessings. So I really encourage you to use the opportunities which, you know, are provided in this tradition, and experiment with them and see how they work. I mean, I remember Ajahn Vajiro said, I don't know whether they work, but at least I have a good feeling if I do it, so they work on me. And I thought, oh, that's a good way to put it, because I was brought up so much, you know, down to earth, no nonsense. So all this kind of blessing and everything you have to believe in, I just didn't want to do that. And I remember, some of you may know Bart and Marion. So Bart and Marion were supposed to be here for the winter retreat, and Marion couldn't come, or she would come a week earlier because she was working, she was leading a hospice in San Francisco, a spiritual Zen hospice. And they had difficulties, and they had a board meeting, and it was about something really important, how they would run the hospice. And she had a very strong feeling about that they should run it in a certain way, and wanted to make a suggestion. And there were lots of board members who were skeptical and opposed what she was suggesting. And she felt that the whole future of the hospice was actually depending on that. So she felt strongly about that. So she stayed there. Bart came on his own. And Ajahn Mehta and myself, we met Bart in Bodhi House and had tea and were chatting, among others, about this. And then at some point she said, can you chant? Can you chant? Time difference. The meeting has just started. So it was 7 o'clock in the evening and 10 o'clock in the morning in San Francisco. Anyway, and Ajahn Mehta and I looked and I said, yeah, we do. So and we did it and we felt good and we left and forgot about it. And next day, Bart came very excited. And said, I have to tell you something. So what? Yeah, you know, it was in the afternoon. I was calling Marion and asked her how did it go, and she said it was bad. It was really bad. It was the worst meeting I ever had, and I gave completely up. And then suddenly at 11 o'clock, something shifted. And suddenly somebody said, oh, why not? Why don't we try it? So, you know, I don't know. I don't take it for granted, but obviously there are things which happen which are beyond what we imagine. And so, you know, faith. How do we arouse faith in ourselves? How do we uplift our hearts? How can we get beyond this sense of me here and this other person or this whatever situation out there? How can we kind of get beyond this avijja, which is actually separating ourselves into subject and object? me and other danger, something happening to me the victim. Because victim is just another feeling. It's just another thing I believe in and reinforce by thinking of me being the victim. So if I refuse to take that as an automatic response and try to work on, you know, how can I change my attitude that I don't have to recreate the situation again and again and again? And so then that's really coming back to the subject of addiction. It's difficult to change addiction because everything resists change. Everything in the body resists change. The body is used to stay in the balance it is used to and will do everything. You know, this is why alcoholics need groups to become clean on your own. It's very hard. So they have groups, support each other. They have practices, they support each other. They take refuge in something higher. And that's usually it's God. Or you can fill in what you like, you know. So they need to go beyond this I, which thinks I'm this and I can't do better. So the element of faith is really important for change. And really experimenting. So when I try to change things in myself, I had, you know, really, it really created fear. The biggest changes I did, you know, coming to the monastery, oh God, can I live there? You're not sure, you know. I was 47 when I came. 47, you know, how can you change when you're 47? Yeah, but I want to change. Yeah, but you can't. You know, you have these inner voices and it just doesn't feel good, you know. So everything wants to convince you can't do it. And knowing about addiction is really important because when these voices come and say you can't do it, it's actually a really good sign because something is stirred up inside. You really did a little change and something inside, no, I don't trust change. I don't trust change, you know. I'm out of balance. Come back. So that's a good sign. If you get a headache, it's a good sign. Really, if you get aggravated, chaos, I'm overwhelmed, a good sign. So just, you know, take a breath and think, okay, change is not what the body wants. So all these alarm signals are, it still needs a bit of discernment, you know, whether it's a healthy alarm signal or it's an unhealthy alarm signal. So it's good to have spiritual teachers to talk about it. It's good to have spiritual companions to talk about it, to support each other in that. It's good to remind ourselves, I can do it. Or, in Buddhist, it's the I again. Maybe you can even use the I to a certain degree as a skillful means. Or in terms of Buddhism, you can, we call transcend. You can transcend feelings by knowledge. So, for example, when you know everything is subject to change, everything is, if I cling, it's dukkha, painful, it's not self. So, like you break something and you can beat yourself up, oh, you know, how could I? Maybe I should have been more mindful. Or you can say, well, yes, everything has a beginning. Everything which has a beginning has an end. So that was the end of it, you know. So actually it's a law. You know, there's a certain degree of relief in that. Right, this is how it should be, you know. Somebody dies, you can, you know, tear your hair out. And you can say, well, this is why we have come, you know, that's part of the deal. You're born and you will die, so there's nothing wrong. It doesn't mean that I have to like it. But in, you know, in this kind of change, there can be, yes, true. And this is what the Buddha taught. So instead of crumbling and getting desperate, you can actually increase your faith with, right, okay, you know, this is what I've signed up for, and I want to make the best of it. So I better learn from it instead of wailing. And so this is how we can transcend suffering really consciously. And sometimes even if it's, there's one way the Buddha says there's one sadness, which is a sadness of a renunciant and which is transcending the usual sadness. And that is when you realize, you know, something is happening and you are still sad. You're still, then you can inspire yourself in saying, oh, look, you know, this is, this loss is something which I find hard to bear with. If I would just be, you know, like the awakened ones. So you create this longing, this aspiration. And that still has a taste of sadness in it, but it transcends the sadness to something which leads you onwards. So that is a very skillful means. You know, sometimes we don't quite live up to what we think we should. So there's still a sadness. You know, you have somebody who's dying and you have all this pain. And then you can think about it. And then, you know, Ajahn Chah would say, well, if I would just be there already. So that opens the door a little bit. So that you don't get lost and, oh, I can't do it and it's all too much. So, I offer that for your reflection. Mm-hmm.